ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. When you think of grandparents, what comes to mind? Maybe a secret stash of lollies? Well, grandparents aren't just spoiling the grandkids anymore. They're raising them and paying the bills. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the joys and pressures of being a modern grandparent. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. Not much more than a century ago, women began fighting their way into national parliaments. The first timers of the world were all fierce, all feminists, but by no means all progressives. Today we're looking at the women pioneers of parliament, some famous and some forgotten, even in their own countries. But first, right-wing parties are more or less alike. Out front is a charismatic leader, and out the back are the party heavies. Together, they write the rules, set the policies, and choose the candidates. Members are left with nothing much to do but chores. That was one nation, but with electoral success now staring the party in the face, it has to adapt and grow, or it's doomed to follow the path it's trodden for the last 30 years. Bursts of success, followed by chaos, and yet more years of electoral oblivion. Jordan McSwinney is a senior research fellow at the Centre for Deliberative Democracy at the University of Canberra. A couple of years ago, he wrote the book Far-Right Political Parties in Australia, Disorganisation and Electoral Failure. Since then, he's been keeping a close eye on and writing about One Nation as it faces the perils of success. Jordan joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, David.
In your writing, you argue again and again that little right-wing parties are terrified of being infiltrated, of being taken over.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a perennial fear among many of them of being white-anted, of being, termites coming in and undermining the party from within. And so we see a lot of far-right parties in Australia, like with One Nation, but also around the world, where they have very, very tight organisational structure, investing power in a small number of people within the organisation, to keep it all under control and prevent that fear of being undermined from their opponents.
So how did One Nation organise this from the start?
Yeah, so the origins of One Nation as a political party are somewhat scandalous and rather interesting, I think. But the organisation was very concerned with being undermined. So they established actually three distinct legal entities when they first formed in 1998. One of those was a company to sort of hold the assets. Another, the Pauline Hanson's One Nation, was a political party registered with the Australian Electoral Commission to contest elections. And the third organisation at the time was called the Pauline Hanson Support Movement Incorporated. The political party had only three members, Pauline Hanson and her two co-founders, the Davids. When people signed up, paid their membership fee, thought they were joining the party, they were actually joining that third organisation, the Pauline Hanson Support Movement. And this got them in quite a lot of legal hot water.
Let's examine that legal hot water, shall we? So first of all, they registered with the Australian Electoral Commission. One Nation registered and swore that they had not three, but 500 members or more.
Yeah, so at the time, the requirement to register was you needed to show a list of about 500, a minimum of 500 members of the party. One Nation provided documents that suggested they had over 1,000. But the devil's in the detail, and those members were not actually members, technically, of Pauline Hanson's One Nation political party, as registered with the AEC, they were actually members of the Pauline Hanson support movement, which the AEC did not look very kindly upon. And so there was a subsequent trial.
No, just a minute. Let us stay with the Australian Electoral Commission at the moment. So the Australian Electoral Commission found, and it's still on the books, that the registration of One Nation was achieved, the application was made, knowing it was false or recklessly not caring whether it was true. And that still remains on the books. And as a result, Pauline Hanson and her colleagues had to return how much money to the Australian Electoral Commission?
It was roughly $500,000.
Roughly $500,000. And they've never got that money back, have they?
No. Though no. They've made plenty since.
Yes. But she was subsequently charged with fraud and convicted and sent to jail.
Yeah, indeed. Quite famously, she would describe herself as Australia's first political prisoner, although it's worth noting that that conviction was overturned about 3 months later.
Yes. So the criminal conviction was overturned, but the judgment of the Australian Electoral Commission remains on foot about that original registration. Now, they changed the policy. They changed the constitution of the party.
Yeah, so Hanson actually left the party before she went to prison. So she left the party in 2002, went to prison in 2003, had a period in the political wilderness. She founded some other political parties, including the Pauline Hanson's United Australia Party, a name that would later come up with Clive Palmer. When she returned to the party, returned to the parliament in 2016.
Who do we have to thank for her getting back into parliament in 2016?
Malcolm Turnbull, I'd say. The double dissolution, I think it's quite plausible that had that not taken place, that double dissolution election, which effectively halves the threshold for a quota, so it makes it much easier to get elected, it's entirely plausible that actually none of the four One Nation members elected at that election would have taken their seats. So
now there's a new constitution for the party.
Yes. So
and how does it protect Pauline Hanson?
Yeah, so the party was redrafted their constitution, which, for context, all political parties have to have a set of rules or a constitution that govern how they operate internally. It's a requirement of the Electoral Commission to register a political party. So what they did in 2017, after Hanson and three colleagues enter Australian Parliament, they introduced a new clause in the constitution that enshrines the presidency of the leadership of the party on Pauline Hanson for life, along with the subsequent powers to handpick her successor. And this is really unusual in the Australian political party context.
I was talking about this show on air earlier today, and I said she had the same situation as the Pope, office for life. But you point out something that the Pope doesn't have, which is the right to appoint her successor.
Yeah, and there's no, you know, exciting conclave for the One Nation leadership either. So I guess we're both losing out. They're both losing out there. But yes, exactly. The Pope is not able to handpick their successor. Pauline Hanson is.
Now, we're talking about all political parties now. Jordan, the constitution of a political party, does it have to be public?
There is not a requirement that the AEC publishes it. A party might choose to put it on their website. They might choose to send it out to their members. It's simply a requirement that it exists and it's submitted to the AEC at the time of registration.
But One Nation has published its constitution.
At some points in history. It's not constantly available, we'll put it that way.
Right. Okay. And is there, because so much public money turns on this, is there a definition of the Australian Electoral Commission of what a member is, what rights a member of a political party should have?
No, there's no legal definition of what a political party member is. It's really up to parties themselves to think about the rights, roles and responsibilities of a member. And indeed, that's a key part of why they have constitutions, to lay that kind of stuff out.
Right. So what powers do members of One Nation, now no longer supporters, but actually members. Of course, they were always told they were members in the past, but now they really are members. What can they do inside the party?
Well, on paper, Being a party member allows you access to things like local branch meetings. It allows you to come along to the annual general meeting of the political party. It allows you to stand as a candidate for the party and stand for various sort of internal office bearer roles, like becoming the treasurer or becoming, you know, taking on some other kind of administrative position within the party. That's in theory. Whether that actually happens in practice is then a separate question, right? These party rules, there's no one else to enforce them. It's up to the party themselves. So if, for whatever reason, they decide not to follow it, no one's going to hold them accountable for that.
Right. So at the end of this week, the Labor Party is gathering. Hundreds of members will gather and they will debate policy.
Mm.
Do the members of One Nation gather and debate policy?
Well, in theory, the annual general meeting of the party is an opportunity to do that. And certainly various members of the party administration have at times talked about the AGM as this kind of forum for members to interact, have their say, vote on matters that matter to the party.
But does it really?
It's hard to get inside those things. You hear differing reports and differing accounts from various characters in and around the party, certainly around the, say, 2019 convention, or the AGM rather. There were a lot of complaints from former members and candidates that there was no meaningful voting on policy positions or positions within the party administration, and some quite famously blew up with the party and left as a result. Other figures in One Nation would dispute that. They suggest that that's a false recollection, that indeed there was votes on the floor. The key point, though, in all of this is that, much like the presence of a constitution, having an AGM is also just a legal requirement of political parties in Australia. So it shouldn't be read necessarily as an indicator of the democratisation of the party or necessarily as a vehicle for members to have their say. It really is just a legal requirement at the end of the day.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I'm talking to Jordan McSwinney, who is the author of the book Far-Right Political Parties in Australia: Disorganisation and Electoral Failure. Now, Jordan, far-right parties, as you describe them, don't have branches.
Well, they do now. One Nation is in the process of setting up one in every single lower house electorate in the country.
Is that going to be possible for them?
It's a huge challenge. I mean, that's a massive upscaling of the party organisation to have 151 local branches. Whether they can pull that off, I think, is very much an open question. Certainly, there have been some seats where they've had a vibrant party on the ground for some time, like the Hunter in New South Wales. But, you know, are they going to be really setting up active, vibrant, ongoing local branches in, say, inner metropolitan seats where their polling is not so high? An open question.
What do the Hunter Valley members get for being a vibrant and energetic branch? Anything much?
It's unclear. Certainly, there's a sense, perhaps, that they feel they're involved in the party. They feel that Hanson listens to them. I mean, when you speak with party members, when you speak with party candidates, and in the reporting around the party, one of the big thing that One Nation members sort of point to is the accessibility and authenticity of Hanson. They feel that she's listening. They feel that they can shape the party's direction. They feel they can go up and, you know, have a chat to her at the pub and she'll take on board what they say. Whether that actually happens, whether that's then implemented, carried up the line, et cetera, doesn't seem to be so important.
Do they select the candidates that are going to stand in their seats?
Historically, no. Although in Farrah, with this pre-selection of David Farley, the candidate that was successful there for One Nation at the recent by-election, for the first time in One Nation's history, they actually had a local branch engage in the pre-selection process. So that's quite a turning point in One Nation. Whether that's going to take place in other electorates, and say, for example, in the Victorian branch of the party ahead of the Victorian state election later this year, have to wait and see.
Now, Farley was, of course, elected and has now a member of the House of Representatives for One Nation, its only representative in the House of Representatives. Now,
Joyce.
Oh, of course, Joyce.
But the only one to win a seat.
The only one to win a seat as
a One
Nation candidate.
Exactly.
Okay. Joyce is there, of course. Two of them. A duumvirate. Now, One Nation has a long record of electing members to parliaments in Australia. An extraordinary number to the Queensland Parliament in 1998, at the time of her problems with the Australian Electoral Commission, and thereafter, here and there. Something like, before the latest members were elected in South Australia and and Farley was elected to the House of Reps, One Nation has put about 30 members into Australian parliaments, rather more than people remember, 30. But at least 22 of those split with the party. Now, why was this? And is there any suggestion that whatever was provoking people to just get out of the party, whether anything's being done to address that problem?
No, there's really not, because the key thing that all of these people who have blow-ups with the party for various reasons tend to come back to is complaints about the internal operation of the party, that it's not democratic enough, and that quite famously was the reason for the collapse of the party's 98 Queensland Senate parliamentary party. There were requests for transformation of the party organisation, democratisation, didn't happen. They all kind of split with the party. The broader picture and what's behind that as well is effectively Hanson and falling outs with Hanson and her style of managing the party and the way in which she has a very top-down autocratic approach to party organisation. So whether it's Mark Latham, the former New South Wales leader of the party, splitting with Hanson in 2023.
Well, this was after Hanson demoted him.
Now, yes, and actually...
Let's be reminded of that story.
Yeah, so Hanson, quite extraordinarily, again, in the context of Australian politics, and an excellent example of the highly centralised, national-oriented, top-down approach of the party, she actually dissolved the entire state executive of the New South Wales party and also basically gave the boot to Mark Latham.
And her reason for doing this?
Yeah, the really vile homophobic comments he made to Alex Greenwich, the local Sydney councillor, that Hanson finally kind of drew a line under, which I think is interesting in the context of someone like Corey Bernardi, the South Australian state leader's historic comments linking homosexuality to bestiality that he continues to refuse to apologise for.
So there's this very interesting contradiction here. The party is Pauline Hanson. Mm. It has never succeeded in its attempts to run without her. Mm-hmm. It needs her. She's the party. And she is the problem once members are elected.
Yeah, I've often said that Hanson is the party's key strength, but also its greatest weakness. I mean, she is the reason, as you say, that they've been able to be electorally successful. She's the reason, effectively, that people vote for the party, they want to join the party, want to stand for the party. And she is absolutely central to their brand. I mean, when you think One Nation, you think Pauline Hanson, right? But her leadership style, her kind of abrasive, I guess, approach to managing her parliamentary colleagues, if we can take the word of those former parliamentary colleagues at face value, is the biggest handbrake on One Nation's success or capacity to translate polling spikes into seats. As you noted earlier, One Nation, really, it doesn't lose its elected members to a vote. It loses them because they split with the party because of a disagreement with Hanson every single time.
It's not policy.
Well, sometimes it is policy. Sometimes it is policy disagreements or disagreements on negotiations on policy in Parliament. So Brian Burston famously was being pushed by Hanson to vote in one direction, but he said he'd made a handshake agreement with the then Liberal government to vote a different direction, and he said his handshake was his word or his sort of honour, and so he split with Hanson over that one. But yes, it typically ultimately comes down to how she actually manages those relationships. And this is a party of big personalities too, so it's sort of, there's a lot of tinder there.
That's true of right-wing parties as well, isn't it? If they have any measure of success, they are around big personalities.
Oh, very much so. I mean, these parties are highly charismatic, for a, you know, lack of a better word. The kind of big, boisterous personalities are really key at driving their vote and their appeal. I think some of the best examples we could point to outside of Australia would be someone like Nigel Farage in the UK, Donald Trump in the US. Also, like Hanson, an interesting sort of career moving around media and reality television as well. There's kind of something in the mix here.
There are parallels.
Yeah. There's something in the mix with reality telly and far-right politicians, perhaps. But certainly that kind of big capacity to kind of command the stage and command the room, never take a step back, never apologise, the sort of Teflon Trump image, that's really quite key and somewhat universal across far-right political parties.
And is it your view that the charismatic leader counts for much more than that leader's policies?
Oh, definitely. I think particularly a party like One Nation, you would have heard, you know, it's a party of grievance, not policy, right? It's about emotional appeals to supporters, members, potential voters, rather than, you know, costed technocratic policy substance. So it's really about making an emotional connection with audiences and sort of bringing them along that journey with you to the polls and hopefully translating that into seats if you're Pauline Hanson.
So in the United States, core support for Trump, recruited by him saying, you've had it tough and you've been betrayed and I'm going to be on your side and things are going to change for you. That has survived the spectacle of him hobnobbing with the rich, giving the rich extraordinary privileges in United States law. That survived. Can Pauline Hanson survive the spectacle of her hobnobbing with the very rich?
Yeah, I think that's a big question of the last couple of weeks in news, really, isn't it? I think in a way, probably. I think there's a degree of, you know, this aspirational view of like, good on your love, get out there, you know, don't let the media kick you down kind of thing. And so I think she will be able to fly straight through with, you know, attending a Dolce & Gabbana show, traveling to Sicily with Gina Reinhart, being given a plane. That sort of stuff, it doesn't seem to dint her brand, which, when the brand is authentic, political outsider, I understand what ordinary people think. It's a really glaring contradiction, but one that so far she's been able to manage quite successfully.
Is it because the followers of right-wing parties want their leaders to be powerful? That is the key demand, that they be powerful. And the sight of Pauline Hanson riding around in a mining magnate's plane and swimming in a Sicilian swimming pool with her, that means power.
Yeah, look, I'm sure it's got something to do with it. I think the biggest thing, though, really is this sense of being a political outsider, of kind of taking the fight to the establishment parties, as Hanson would put it, taking the fight to, as they would put it, traditional media, and this idea that she's kind of straight talking, this ordinariness, this idea that she's going to say what everyone's thinking. And I think it's this quite confected, I would say, authenticity that is really the key appeal for Hanson among her supporters.
Jordan, if you were advising Angus Taylor, what do you think is the strategy that can bring One Nation down?
Yeah, I think parties of any stripe in Australia, you underestimate Hanson and One Nation at your own peril. I think they present a more significant challenge than either party has really taken seriously to this point, and that's to their own detriment. I think the biggest challenge that the Liberal Party has faced in trying to take the fight to One Nation is that they haven't tried to take the fight to One Nation. They have been very much tiptoeing around questions around like the monoculture debate, around immigration, and essentially trying to say to prospective One Nation voters, we'll give you something similar, but you can trust us to deliver it because we have governing experience. And I just think that's not a very strong point of differentiation because, as Hanson herself would say, why go for the copy when you can have the original? So I think trying to ape One Nation's policies, really puts the Liberal Party at a disadvantage. You're never going to be able to outbid One Nation on the right flank on something like immigration, let's say. And it also shifts the debate and the political battle to One Nation's preferred territory. I think what the Liberals are starting to do at the moment and move the discussion more into sort of dry economic policy, that's not territory One Nation's comfortable in. So trying to fight them on immigration is, I think, a disaster, whereas trying to take the fight to them in a space they're not comfortable, greater possibility for movement there.
But the big difference between the party a few years ago and One Nation now is money.
Yeah, it's the big difference. You know, having Australia's richest woman, Gina Rinehart, full-throated support for the party, financial support for the party, is a massive legitimising event. It's also the financing can provide such a higher level of professionalisation in terms of consultants and third-party operators who can come in and help with social media, campaign messaging, focus groups, all the research that goes into a political campaign.
Building branches on the ground?
Potentially, certainly building the back end for your digital ecosystem. So it provides them a level of resourcing they've never ever had as a minor party. And that's going to be a real big step for them in terms of becoming a slicker and more competitive electoral machine. But I think that's also perhaps where some of the biggest risk for the party lies, because as you become a slicker, more professional, smoother operating political party, well, you stop looking like the little guy. You stop looking like the outsider who's here to shake things up in the Canberra bubble. You actually just start looking like all the politicians that you say you're there to take the fight to.
Do you think Barnaby Joyce is comfortable?
Well, Barnaby has said he's very comfortable. He's given numerous interviews just saying how great a relationship he has with Hanson. There's a part of me that always thinks if you have to come out and tell us how much you love your boss, you probably don't love working with your boss so much at the moment. But, you know, I do wonder if he expected to have so much heat when he stepped across. But I don't expect he's going to jump ship anytime soon.
Jordan, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks, David.
I've been talking to Jordan McSwinney, who is the author of the book Far-Right Political Parties in Australia, Disorganisation and Electoral Failure. It's really fascinating study of what's happening out on the right in this country. Coming up, the trailblazing and sometimes pistol-packing women who first stormed parliaments. Parliaments were for men for hundreds of years, men only. Then women got the vote, and not long after, the inevitable happened. Women were elected. Who the first of these women were, how they got there, and what they did once they had a place in Parliament is the subject of historian Paula Bartley's new book, Trailblazers, The First Women Elected to Government. Paula is the author of half a dozen books on women political pioneers and honorary research fellow at the University of Warwick. And she joins me now from her little-known hometown, Stratford-upon-Avon. Paula, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How many women, how many parliaments, how many years? What's the scope of the book?
Well, it's quite a wide scope, actually. It's a story of 44 extraordinary women from 42 different countries, ranging from Afghanistan through to Zimbabwe. And these were women who trailblazed their way into a previous male-only space. As you said, women weren't in parliament at the beginning of the 20th century. Women had the vote in some jurisdictions, but they didn't have the right or the success in entering parliament. And in 1907, this changed quite dramatically with a Finnish woman. I can speak about her a bit later on, if you like. And I think the 20th century, I call it the age of democracy. And it's when democracy of some sort or another becomes established across the world. And I think democracy is good for women. When it collapses, women suffer. And I wanted a biographical approach because I wanted to blend the personal with the political. I'm an old feminist, and this is what we always did. And what I wanted to do is to make high politics a bit more user-friendly because politicians are human beings, and dehumanise them makes them vulnerable. We've just had Anne Widdecombe murdered in our country, which is horrendous. And that's because they don't see politicians as human beings. And so what I've tried to do is to bring that out in the book.
Paula, is there any way we can say these women were alike? They're from so many different societies over a long period of time, all doing the same thing, pioneers entering these men-only spaces. Are they alike in any way?
No. I mean, it's hard to find some common themes in the 44 women. But what they all did is they interrupted the narrative masculinity merely by being present in governments. And I think another common thread that united them, and I think this is politicians in general, really, they wanted to transform their country into a better place. And most of them were motivated by a very strong sense of commitment. And they were all wanting to address some form of social injustice, promote equality for women mostly, and create a very inclusive society. And a lot of them were feminists, but they're different kinds of feminists. Feminists, I said in my book, is a bit like a benevolent hydra. It's got many heads.
They wanted a better society. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were all progressives.
No. Well, progress is funny, really. It's a funny thing because sometimes we think things are progressive and that they're actually not. And I'm always interested, really, in Iran, because Iran deposed the Shah and that was seen as progressive, and actually it wasn't in the end. So no, but they were progressive in some ways. I mean, there was an American woman, the first woman to be elected in America was a Republican, Jeanette Rankin. And she, I think she would be called a rhino now, Republican in name only. But she really fought for the rights of women, and she was elected before women got the votes nationwide in America, interestingly. And she fought to get them there. So although she was a Republican, and we think of Republicans, well, certainly today, heaven above, as being the baddies, Jeanette Rankin was an interesting figure in there. She sat in uncomfortably.
This is what makes particularly fascinating the first woman to enter the National Parliament of Finland.
Yes.
Now tell us about her.
I love her. Absolutely love her. She was a lesbian, feminist, vegetarian, and her name was Hilda Kakikoski. And she stepped into world history. She was one of 19 women elected to the Finnish Parliament. And the Finnish Parliament is called the Eduskunta. I didn't know any of this when I started the book. Now, these women were the first women in the world to be elected in any country. And it was extraordinary. And it was a bit of a surprise. Now, for those who don't know, and I certainly didn't, at the time in 1907, Finland was part of the Russian Empire. But in 1905, a revolution in Russia, a very unsuccessful war with Japan, and unrest in Finland forced the Tsar to concede some kind of power. And Finland was granted home rule. And it took a radical route. And all adults, men and women, over the age of 23, were given the right to vote and the right to stand for election. Now, I find this quite interesting because the Russian Tsar didn't give his own people the same rights. So it was a great leap forward. And I chose Hilda because I was really fascinated by her. Because everything I've said about her, she was a vegetarian, she was a lesbian, she was a feminist, she was a suffragist activist, and she seemed very woke in today's terms. Paradoxically, she stood as a conservative candidate. And this is, I think, still a nationalist party which promotes the Finnish language and Finnish. Now, why was this? I found this absolutely fascinating. Given her beliefs, her natural political home seemed to be the Socialist Party. But I think a couple of explanations for her political preferences occurred to me, and they certainly have resonance today. Hilda was patriotic, and she probably felt that the Finnish Conservative Party was the only party that shared this belief. the more left-wing parties, as they are now, are much more international in their outlook. And I do find this kind of patriotic feminism fascinating. And it's often based, certainly in the UK where I'm based, on emotion rather than reason. Now, when Hilda was born, the language of the Finnish government was Swedish. Now, Hilda hated this. She thought it was shocking that Finns were forced to speak a foreign language in their own country. And she wanted to take back control. So she wanted Finland to be Finnish. And she was proud of her Finnish heritage. She had a birth surname, which was Sjöström. Now, this was a Swedish word, and she changed her name to Kakikowski because it sounded more Finnish.
But Hilda was also in favour of and campaigned for chastity.
She did, and I find that extraordinary because she was a lesbian. She had relationships with about five women. Now, was it chastity for men? I couldn't find out very much more than that.
I'm sure it
and
was.
Yes, it wasn't chastity for women. That was a big suffrage campaign across the world. I mean, in England, Christabel Pankhurst and the WSPU and Emmeline Pankhurst had votes for women, chastity for men as their slogan. So I think Hilda was talking about a very narrow strand of chastity, which probably didn't apply to herself, which is extraordinary. And she was very open about her lesbianism. And at the time, I think you got 2 years in prison if you were found guilty. But she kind of didn't worry too much about that.
Yes, but to what extent were those early women parliamentarians driven by moral causes, not just chastity, but also temperance?
Oh, yes, temperance comes up quite a bit, certainly in New Zealand. Elizabeth Reed McCombs, I think, was the first woman to be elected in Parliament. And she said, the lips that taste wine will never kiss mine. Now, that was a slogan, I think, across the world. That was certainly the case in America, big temperance movement.
My mother used to joke about that.
Did she?
That's where it comes from. It was one of her jokes.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Oh, I didn't know. Well, this is Elizabeth Reed McCombs. I mean, I don't know whether she originated it or whether that was a slogan worldwide. Probably a slogan worldwide, I should imagine. But yes, the temperance movement was very strong. It wasn't very strong in Britain. One of our first MPs to take a seat, Nancy Astor, was a temperance advocate. But nobody took any notice. But it was big in the States, as we know.
As we know.
I don't know how big it was elsewhere.
Well, it certainly didn't work in Australia or New Zealand. But now, now Paula, you argue in the book that the First World War was important here.
Yes. I think what's extraordinary about wars is that they can be progressive. Oh, they're so destructive of human life, aren't they? But they actually do create opportunities for women. And the First World War, if you think about it, it collapsed a lot of empires. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire wobbled. And that created opportunities. And certainly in Hungary, the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed. And Hungary became, I think for the first time, an independent republic, an independent country. And they elected, I think she's one of my first and most favourite women. She was a Catholic. She was a nun. And she was the only woman elected to Parliament in 1920, was it? And what a nun she was. I mean, she wasn't... I love her to bits. I mean, I have a Hungarian family, so it's a double love, if you know what I mean. She wasn't a retiring, silent nun hiding away behind convent walls, but an activist and tireless fighter for women. And in Parliament, she delivered something like 28 speeches asking for women's rights. Her party, which was the Christian Party, didn't like her, a bit like Jeanette Rankin in America. And after only 2 years in Parliament, she was deselected. And she was also dismissed from her convent and had her vows annulled. But these women, in the like Margit, were fighters. And there's no way she'll allow any setback to inhibit her. So she founded her own convent. And she was committed to helping the poor and the vulnerable, but also to campaign politically. She also rejected the traditional nun's habit. You know, she had a little grey tunic and a white blouse. But more importantly, she was brave. In the 1930s, Jewish Hungarians began to have their legal rights removed. They had their possessions confiscated, they were dismissed from their jobs, and later they were forced to wear a yellow star. They were beaten up and murdered by their fellow citizens. Now, Margit saw anti-Semitism as a direct contradiction of the Ten Commandments and of Christian beliefs. So she was fired up by her Christianity. And in 1940, as we know, Hungary joined the Second World War on the side of the Nazis. And it's something they like to forget, really. And life got much worse for Jewish Hungarians. They were deported to death camps. But Sister Margit told her nuns that their Christian beliefs and values meant that they should protect the Jewish population. But she was a solitary voice crying in the wilderness, and the rest of the Christian community remained silent. She had a visit with the Pope and tried to get him to expel Hungarian Catholics who supported anti-Semitism, to no avail. She talked to the chief person in Hungary, I don't know their names, Archbishop or somebody or other, didn't want to know. So she was alone very much in her fight. So what did she do? It's a bit like Julie Andrews in that film. She forged baptismal certificates and identity papers for Jewish people. She sent food to the ghettos. She sheltered people in her convents. She was tortured. She was put in prison. And she only narrowly escaped the death penalty. Indeed, a few of her nuns were taken prisoner and thrown in the River Danube. Can you believe it? But under Sister Margit's guidance, her order, rescued more than 2,000 Hungarian Jews. And she's now in Yad Vashem, you know, I think it's in Tel Aviv, the commemoration for non-Jewish people who helped Jewish people. But unfortunately, you know, after the Second World War, she was re-elected to Parliament. Great, wonderful. Here we are, great resistance fighter, heroine. Not at all. Because, of course, Russia started dominating Hungary. So her next challenge was from the left. And the Russian communists did not like Christianity, did not like the Catholic Church. And once again, Margit was persecuted. And basically, she fled for her life. And she went to Buffalo, I think, New York, and set up her sister's there and died in America. But she always wanted to go back to her home country. She was Hungarian. And I think just recently, I think in 2021, her body was flown back and she was reburied in the National Cemetery. And that's a big thing for Hungary, because Hungarians were terrible, the anti-Semitism there. And now to have a heroine who fought against that kind of makes the country feel a bit proud. But she's not known about. She really isn't known about in Hungary.
She's not celebrated.
No, she does beginning to be known about. I mean, I have Hungarian relatives. They're all very well educated, all very clever. In fact, one of them is now a Minister of Culture and Education in the new government. They hadn't heard of her. I said, I can't believe it. She was the first woman to enter the Hungarian Parliament. And look what she did. But no, they're just, you know, their history is about dead white men in power.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to the historian Paula Bartley about her book Trailblazers, the first women elected to government to enter parliaments. There is a woman here that I've always wanted to know more about, Constance Gore Booth, who ended up as Countess Constance Markowitz.
Yes. Well, she was the first woman to be elected to the British Parliament. At the time, she was in prison. and she just had her death sentence reduced to life imprisonment. But she was elected. Obviously, she couldn't take her seat. Now, I find this absolutely fascinating because there was a big women's suffrage movement in Britain, 19th century, 20th century, with the Pankhursts. Crystal Pankhurst stood for election. She wasn't elected. And none of the other 17 women were either. So the suffragists and the suffragettes who had been campaigning for over 100 years for the vote saw this convicted traitor being elected, which is quite extraordinary. She was countess. She came from an upper class, sort of aristocratic family, Anglo-Irish family. And she spent her childhood in this big mansion house, one of the biggest and grandest estates in Ireland. And she, you know, did the usual things. She lived an idyllic life. She walked by the sea. She rode horses. She hunted foxes and, I don't know, small birds. And she mixed with the social and intellectual elite of Ireland. She was so posh, she was presented at Queen Victoria's Court. Now, how and why did this rather beautiful, enchanting young aristocrat defy the social conventions of her class and find herself in prison? Well, it's a kind of long story. At first, she was part of the elite. She got married to this count who was a Polish count and she became a countess. But she was also an artist. And as an artist, she began moving in bohemian circles and she gradually became attracted to Irish nationalism. At the time, all the island of Ireland was governed by British.
Oh, yes.
By Britain. And the Irish wanted their independence. And Constance agreed. And she became a Republican. She became a member of Sinn Féin. And she abandoned her diamonds and pearls. And she launched her Republican career. In 1914, as we know, Britain declared war on Germany. Constance and the other Irish nationalists refused to support Britain and took advantage of the fact that Britain's armed forces were away, absent from Ireland, fighting elsewhere. And on Easter Monday 1916, Constance prepared to overthrow the British government. I think this is wonderful. So you've got these photographs of her with these silk frocks down to her ankles and covered in diamonds and pearls. And the next one you see, she's in military uniform with a gun slung across her shoulder. And so this floating landmine, this is what her husband called her.
A floating landmine.
And that's a wonderful floating landmine.
It's pretty
landmine.
Good.
Yeah, decided that she wanted to overthrow the British government. So on Easter Monday, she tried and she declared Ireland a republic. It was a revolution. And the plan was to encircle Dublin, take it by force and wait for the rest of Ireland to join the uprising.
Now, Paula.
They
we
didn't.
Can't, we cannot tell the story of the failed uprising of 1916 now.
Okay.
But it's there. Let's jump forward slightly and ask, did she ever get out of prison and take her seat in the House of Commons?
No, she didn't. She didn't because, of course, part of Ireland became independent in, I think it was 1922. So she lost her seat. And even if she had been out of prison, she wouldn't have taken it because Sinn Féin, they wouldn't take an oath of loyalty to the British government. They don't recognise the British government.
Yes.
So she wouldn't have taken a seat anyway. But no, she didn't.
Let's, Paula, jump to the other side of the world and to Indonesia. Tell us about the first woman to enter the Indonesian parliament and when.
Well, the first woman was Umi Sujarno. So it was in the mid-1950s. In 1945, Indonesia freed itself from the Dutch Empire and declared its independence. And 10 years later, elections were held in which 17 women were elected, one of whom was Umi Sujarno. She was an atheist, she was an anti-fascist, she was a feminist and communist. And she had fought in the Indonesian independence movement. And she was one of the country's most prominent political activists. And she witnessed seismic changes. I mean, she witnessed the end of Dutch colonial rule, Japanese occupation, independence war, and a brutal militaristic regime. So Umi started, she was part of the elite, her parents were part of the elite. She was very well educated, and she married another communist, a prominent communist. When the Japanese invaded in the Second World War, she and her husband joined the resistance, obviously. And what intrigues me, they ran a food stall for Japanese soldiers. She used it to gain information. So she chatted to the soldiers. She found out about their movements and what have you, and reported it back. She did discover important information, but she was arrested. She was imprisoned and she was tortured. And in a later interview, Umi spoke of being beaten while upside down, deprived of food and water, and forced to drink her own urine. You think that would be bad? Now, Umi was a communist, and I love the way that the feminist movement reaches out across the world. And she was influenced by Clara Zetkin, who was one of the first women to be elected to the German parliament. And she described her as a socialist female warrior. And like Clara, Umi believed that only a complete transformation of economics and an end to capitalism would allow people to breathe freely and live well. And in 1948, she organised Indonesia's first International Women's Day, which had been started by Clara Zetkin, and now, of course, it's all around the world. Now, she was elected, and when she was elected, she tried to do things like end forced marriages, end polygamy, end child marriage, and to introduce equal marital legislation. Her ideas really received an antagonistic response. And in 1965, there was a failed coup d'etat in Indonesia, but the coup was blamed on the Indonesian Communist Party. And that was actually the third largest communist party in the world at the time. And Suharto, General Suharto, seized power. And he made the feminist organisation that she led, called Jawani, an illegal organisation. She might have been an MP. It didn't make the slightest difference. Suharto and his nasty soldiers tortured, murdered.
How did she survive?
Heaven knows how she survived. I absolutely don't know. She managed to survive prison, but she lived for the rest of her life crippled and believing that she was under constant surveillance, which she was, of course, and was in danger of being arrested. She managed to kind of live on until she was 87, but she was in pain, she was in poverty, she couldn't get work, she couldn't get anybody to help her economically. And in this murderous regime lasted until 1998, of course, and it murdered something like 500,000 people. Only in 2015, that's just 11 years ago, the Indonesian government was held responsible for mass murder, for her wrongful imprisonment. She's one of my all-time heroines, quite honestly. She's amazing. And people just don't know about her.
She's not honoured in Indonesia?
No. I mean, they were very nice in Indonesia, actually. They sent me a lovely photograph of her that I've got in the book.
Paula, we have to draw this to a close. We have discussed something like, I think, four of the women.
Yeah.
There are 40 to go for lucky readers.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much. And can I give a shout out to my favourite woman, who's Graça Machel, who was one of the first women to be elected in Mozambique. But that's another story.
That's a Thank whole you very other much, David. And exciting story. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Paula Bartley, historian and author of Trailblazers, The First Women Elected to Government. It's published by Polity. And that's the show. On our next, Slavery and Australia. In 1833, when Britain ended slavery, £20 million in compensation paid to slave owners, and in today's money that's over £2 billion, it flowed into every corner of the empire, including Australia. Slavery shaped this place in ways we're only now discovering, from sheep and sugar to governors.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.